Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, March 13th, day number 72 of 2013, and so far, only black smoke. So far. I have a funny feeling, I don't like to bet on these things, but I have a funny feeling that we're going to have black smoke for today, and then I think we'll see white smoke tomorrow. That's just my gut feeling, nothing more than just a gut feeling. I just think that this is an important selection, and I think there's probably a lot of stuff going on inside, a lot of good stuff, I should say, nothing bad, but just good things going on, good things going back and forth, and I think the Cardinals are probably just, they understand that this is an important one, and I think they're going back and forth. So my prediction is that we'll see some smoke about this time tomorrow. So I know I could be wrong, but that's just my gut feeling. This is our U.S. Latin America show. Today we'll be, of course, joined by Michael Prada, by Fausto Wirtz. And we have a special guest in our first segment. Israel Ortega of the Heritage Foundation is going to be joining us. Of course, many of us have spoken to or have followed Israel's work at the Heritage Foundation with La Libertad, which is one of the great resources of the Heritage Foundation. So we'll be talking with him in a couple of minutes. Just a quick update again on my book. It is available in print. It is available in Kindle. You can get it either way. I kind of like print, but if you're one of those that likes to read it on your little computer, we have it available on Kindle. And last Friday, there was a great write-up about the book on the Texas A&M student newspaper. And as you know, both of my sons went to Texas A&M. Actually, one of our sons is in the U.S. Army. I don't want to leave him out because he's doing some very important work as well. But the two sons that went to college did go to Texas A&M. And when Texas A&M found out that they had worked with their dad on a book, they said, "Hey, man, we got to do something about this." So they wrote this great article last Sunday on the Texas A&M newspaper, which is rightfully called the Battalion, which is of course a reference to the long tradition of Texas A&M as a military school, going back to, I mean, the newspaper goes back to 1893, if you can believe it. But great article, I loved it. It was an absolutely fantastic article, and I put it on Facebook and I put it on Twitter. So those of you who follow me along those two social networks, I'm sure you had a chance to see the article. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have Israel Ortega, Fausto Wirtz, and Michael Prada. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and if you're listening to us for the first time, and we thank the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program today. If you're listening to us for the first time, thank you so much. We do this every week. We do a U.S. Latin America show, and we usually have a guest in the first hour, and then we have our panel discussion later on. So let me say hello to Israel Ortega. How are you, Israel?
Hey, good, Silvio. How are you?
Absolutely great. Let me say hello to Fausto Wirtz. How are you, Fausto?
Doing great, Silvio. Thank you. How are you?
Great. And, of course, Michael Prada. How are you?
Hi, Silvio.
I don't know if the three of you have met. I think Fausto has met Israel. Maybe Michael has. But I thought if we could just do a quick introduction. Israel, since you're our guest today, tell us a little bit about yourself and the great work that you do with the Heritage Foundation.
Sure, glad to, Silvio. Thanks. Yes, I handle the Heritage Libertad initiative for the Heritage Foundation, which is essentially trying to get our work and research out to Hispanic media, but also to Hispanics all across the country and across Latin America. So I've been doing this work for the last few years, but I've been with the Heritage Foundation for the last 6 years.
great. And Fausta, just a quick update.
I blog at faustasblog.com on American and Latin American politics. On every Monday, I have a roundup of news and blog posts on Latin America called The Carnival of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Great. And Michael, sounds like you're driving a truck, Michael.
I'm sorry. I'm having issues with my phone.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you were driving a truck down 95 on your way to see Betsy.
No, actually down Manhattan. No. I'm the president and CEO of the International Center for Democracy, which is a non-profit organization that works with conservative movements around the world.
Great. Well, we're going to be talking today in the first segment about Mexico, and then we'll get into Latin America with Michael and Fausta, and there's a lot of stuff going on. As Fausta indicated, she runs a carnival of stories on her blog every Monday, and very often that's where we take many of our topics for the program. But Israel, I wanted to begin with you because Mexico has been in the news a little bit lately for a very interesting reason, and that is the Public Teachers Union is apparently under the microscope down there, and I thought we could talk a little bit about that and your perspective on the arrest of this lady who runs the union.
Yes, no, it's a lot of exciting things happening in Mexico, Silvio, as you rightly stated. And for me, this is a personal thing. My family and I came from Mexico when I was very young, and I traveled to Mexico quite a bit. A few years ago, I was meeting with young Mexican conservatives, libertarians, who were kind of hoping for what we're seeing now. And a few years ago, my colleague and I, Jim Roberts, wrote a research paper actually talking about taking on some of these special interests. That is, Mexico should look at reforming its economy by injecting more competition into the system. And one of the topics that we briefly touched on was the education system. Elba Esther Gordilla has been a teacher union representative for a very long time, and she's also gotten quite wealthy throughout her time. She has a home in San Diego, and she travels in first class everywhere she goes. But the fact that President Enrique Peña Nieto has decided to take her on, I think, is a very important step in terms of doing something that Mexico really hasn't done in a long time, which is take on some of these sacred cows. And so it's still to be determined, you know, whether or not Elba Esther Gordillo will have a long sentence for some of the corruption and bribery charges against her. But at the very least, I think it does show that Enrique Peña Nieto is really serious about taking on some of these really big and thorny issues for Mexico.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Now, I was wondering, though, how much of this is corruption and how much of this is reform. In other words, did it simply get to the point where the corruption was just so high? I mean, like you say, you know, she's alleged to have homes in the United States, and, you know, this lady obviously does not live on the salary of a public teacher in Mexico. So I was wondering how much of it was corruption, meaning it just got too much, or how much of it was actually reform, you know, reform, where he's simply saying, you know what, I want to do something about this. Because speaking of reform, he's also talking about Pemex, which is, I think, very good to hear these two things from the new president, Israel.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think to your first question, I think you're right. I think that this arrest does not solve solve Mexico's educational crisis. Like Mexico and like us, unfortunately, the system needs many reforms. One of the ways I think it's going to do this is by really just basically stating an obvious fact, which is that the teachers' unions in Mexico have really been calling the shots for a very long time. And, of course, we know the results are disastrous. And so I think at the very least, it is going to put a magnifying glass in Mexico's educational system. And the hopes is that President-elect Peña Nieto, or President Mexico Peña Nieto, will then start taking some more aggressive, specific educational reforms. On the question of Pemex, yeah, this is another development that's happening. Again, there's no specific legislation right now, as far as I know. But there are general guidelines as to what it would look like. And I think one of the most encouraging things would be the fact that Mexico would be opening itself up to private investment on the energy sector, which is something that, again, for a very long time, I didn't think we'd see. because of nationalistic interests and a variety of other reasons. Mexico seemed resistant to foreign investment in its through Pemex, you know, the biggest monopoly of oil, petroleum. So again, we'll have to wait and see, but it is encouraging both
right.
these things.
No, I agree with you. They're both the right signals. Now, one last question, and then I'll let Fausta ask you a question. This lady, and please repeat her name because I always get her name confused.
Elba Esther Gordillo.
Okay, Gordillo. Okay, I wanted to make sure that was her name because I didn't want women to get mad at me for calling her something else. But so Madam Gordillo, let's just refer to her as Madam
uh-huh.
Gordillo. She was actually in very good terms with President Calderon. I mean, when
yeah.
President Calderon, the previous president, of course, was in power, they actually developed a very close relationship in a policy basis, which
yeah.
is a bit unusual given that the PAN was more of a right-of-center candidate that or party that has been very closely
mm-hmm.
associated with the Catholic Church and the Catholic
mm-hmm.
schools in Mexico. So is this does this have anything to do with that? It just seemed to me a little bit too
mm-hmm.
much of a coincidence there.
Mm-hmm. No, well, to your first thing, you know, you can always refer to her as La Maestra.
Right, La Maestra.
Silvio,
right.
Everywhere in Mexico knows her as La Maestra.
Right.
So, if
La
you
Maestra
forever forget her name.
Tiene una, say, La Maestra que tiene una casa en San Diego, right?
Right, right. yeah, well, look, I think, you know, you're right, Calderon actually did talk about early in his administration that he was going to take on a lot of these vested interests and special interests. But eventually he relented and he did strike a deal, essentially. He saw that it would actually make more sense to actually work with La Maestra. And so you're right, he didn't do this. I think what's interesting, particularly if you look at Mexico right now, on the telecommunications side, just looking at that, yesterday they had a big press conference in Mexico City, I believe, and it was a number of the parties that actually were working to basically agree that they need to take on telecommunications. So I think all of the parties in Mexico recognize that something has to be done, and I think that is a departure from what we've seen in Mexico in years past.
Right. And one more thing. I don't know if you remember this, Israel, Fausta, you may remember this. I think Michael is too young to remember this. But when Salinas took over from Miguel de la Madrid in
uh-huh.
December 1988, the first thing he did, he locked up the head of the Pemex Workers Union for corruption.
Mm-hmm.
He locked
mm-hmm.
him up, and it was a big thing. You know, they went to his house, and they dragged him out of his house. And many people back then were telling me that this was like something that presidents do when they take over. They usually have one big move just to let everybody know in the bureaucracy that they're the new guy in town and they're in charge.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a, you know, a way of making a statement, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this particular incident with La Maestra just caught me a little bit by surprise. Not that she doesn't
mm-hmm.
deserve these indictments. I'm just saying
yeah.
the timing
yeah.
of it is caught me by surprise. But, you know, let me bring in Fausta Wirtz, and Fausta has a question for you.
The as I understand it, Israel, that the Mexican education budget goes to the teachers' union to divide among its members. Even if she is arrested, would that change or would that continue the same? I mean, do you see any change in that?
Right. I think that goes into the specific legislation that would need to be introduced, Fausta, because that's an excellent point. I don't think that this arrest alone is going to solve some of the systemic things that need to be done in the Mexico's educational system. Right now, for instance, in Mexico, you know, if you control enough of power because you moved up in the ranks in the unions, you can actually secure a job for a friend. Whether or not the person is qualified. Like in our country, it's also exceedingly difficult to fire an ineffective teacher. This is going to require this to work through the Mexican legislature. Enrique Peña Nieto can get behind that, but of course it needs to get start in the legislative process. So that's the specific stuff, Fausta, I think that will need to happen if Mexico is really truly going to address its dysfunction in its system, educational system.
Okay, Michael? Did we lose Michael? Wait a
Uh-oh.
Minute. No, there. Wait a minute. There he is. Hey, Michael, you're on.
Okay, perfect. The question I have for Israel is the following. How long do you think this Pact for Mexico, which is the name of the agreement between the three major political parties that are in Congress, is going to last?
I think the window is quite short. I mean, I think that, any new president, he's got a lot of political capital at the beginning, and then it's going to subside as public opinion starts to change. So I think that, I think a year, I think this year is going to be key for Enrique Peña Nieto. I think the coalition is stable, but it's not strong. And I think some of it's going to depend on just how much support they get from the Mexican people. I think if some of these reforms start to have an immediate impact, then I think you could see this holding on a bit more. But in terms of a long-lasting thing, they've got an election coming up next year, and so they of course will start looking at getting advantage politically for some of these reforms. So. To answer your question, I think it's going to be a short window.
Yeah, interesting. Let me ask you a question. You were talking about the upcoming elections. This is, I think, the biggest change that I've seen in 20 or 25 years or so that I followed Mexican politics through business and family relations, that this is indeed the biggest change, that the opposition actually matters now. I mean, I can remember, when De La Madrid was president or, of course, even going back, López Portillo, that really the opposition was just, filling up seats. But they really didn't have any power. It was very much of a presidential system. But that's not true anymore. What I hear from Mexican friends right now is that you really have to, the legislature is now very active and mm-hmm. very much of an opposition party. And in this case, of mm-hmm. course, it would be PAN and the PRD.
Right, absolutely. And I think the other interesting thing, too, that needs to be brought up, Silvio and everybody else, is the fact that the civil society in Mexico, I think, is being strengthened in the last few years. And I think a lot of it has to do, as you all know, because of middle class in Mexico is growing. And I think that is causing a lot of folks to just question Mexican politics, but just some of the Mexican institutions. Most encouraging to me has been the support or the interest among young Mexicans. There's a movement actually started by a friend of mine called Un Millón por México. And what it is essentially just a book that just talks about some of the reforms that Mexico needs. And it's a initiative by young people. And I think that is an encouraging sign of hopefully what's more to come in Mexico, because I think that if you start seeing a change in the civil society, that's going to translate into more substantive political reform.
Right. No, and it's interesting because I, through family relations, I have many, many nephews and nieces who are young Mexicans in their 20s, like my sons. And when you talk to them, you could see that they're not happy with the corruption in their country. I'm not saying they want to mm-hmm. throw the whole system away, but they're like ashamed of their mm-hmm. corruption, and that they want a clean government, Israel. They want a government mm-hmm. that is clean, that is transparent, very very much like young people up here in the 60s for different reasons, but that's what they want. So I think you're exactly right. I think that is a good thing. Now, there's two other topics I want to bring up. One is good and one is bad about Mexico, and then I'll let Fausta and Michael ask you a question. The good one is the economy is doing well. I mean, by every indication. Mm-hmm. Now, I know the unemployment rate of 4% mm-hmm. doesn't include all the underground economy and all of that, but mm-hmm. All the underemployment and all of that, but that's a pretty good unemployment rate mm-hmm. for Mexico.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think that it goes to show you that Mexico is beginning to diversify its economy. I think that they've always been open to trade. They recognize that's important. I think that hopefully tourism will start picking up, and that's going to generate some more revenue for Mexico as well. But I think that the fact that the purchasing power among Mexico's middle class, I think is a sign, especially for foreign investors. I want to say one of the big credit agencies yesterday actually upgraded Mexico's standing from I think it was like positive to good. I forget the exact terminology. So I think that hopefully can be sustained. I think that I think private investors have to be encouraged about what they're seeing in terms of diversifying, or I'm sorry, in terms of injecting some competition into some of the big industries in Mexico, and hopefully that will cause more growth and really probably less immigration. Really, is more opportunities are created in Mexico. More Mexican, more younger Mexicans will decide to stay home.
Right, and the bad thing, of course, is that the violence is still a problem. And in fact, this is something I picked up in Fausta's blog in the carnival on Monday, Fausta, that there was a firefight in Reynosa a couple of days ago. That people who are on either side of the border, I mean, some people on the Texas side of the border who have been to Iraq and Afghanistan, they said that it sounded like they were there. You know, the quality mm-hmm. of the machines, you know, the mm-hmm. firefight was incredible.
Yeah.
Apparently two cartel groups decided to have a disagreement in the streets, and it turned into a huge firefight with quite a few dead people. So that part of the story is still a problem.
Yeah.
Fausta?
Another thing with the Pemex upcoming legislation, how much does Peña Nieto have to depend on bringing together, you know, like not only the PRI but every other party?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's huge, Fausta. It's going to be critical, and I think that the president has to use the template that's been working fairly well for him, telecommunications side. I think he has to replicate that into the energy one, because that will be the heavier lift. And I think that if Peña Nieto's smart, he'll start working with the PAN quite quickly on this. The PAN, the PAN will be receptive to this. They've in their platform before, and just through my travels in Mexico, know that PAN would be open to this idea of on the energy sector, of privatizing the energy sector, or at least partially privatizing the energy sector. I think the PRD is will be important as well, but you know they'll want concessions for on labor union needs that they have. They depend a lot on unions for their support. But I think it's possible. I think it's possible. I think that if he works with them on the telecommunications, perhaps that will create some goodwill to then take on the heavier lift, which will be the energy sector.
Yeah.
Actually,
Standard
& Poor's upgraded Mexico's debt from positive to stable.
Wow.
Yeah,
because
that's
of energy
that's
reform.
That's what I was referring to earlier. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah, that is great.
That was
Michael.
Yesterday.
Yeah, that was a great point, Fausto. Michael?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Israel, you mentioned earlier the whole issue about the president taking on the telecommunications industry. How successful do you think he's going to be in doing that when he's, you know, basically pissing off, getting upset that, you know, the richest man in the world, which is, you know, Carlos Slim, who controls 70% of the telecommunications industry in Mexico?
I think it'll be easier because I think, as you just rightly pointed out, this is becoming into taking on Carlos Slim. As you know, not a ton of people in Mexico want to necessarily defend Carlos Slim and his lifestyle, and I think that's going to make it easier target for Peña Nieto if he can make this. It'll have a little bit of a populist pitch, and so that appeals to the lower middle class of Mexico, and so I think that's why in comparative terms it'll be easier to do telecommunications than the energy side. I as someone who doesn't thinks populism is bad policy many times or all the time, I would just would want to make sure that Peña Nieto doesn't go exceedingly far, because there's nothing wrong with being successful and doing well in the free enterprise system. I think that it's important to have competition, but again, hoping that he doesn't lurch so far to the left to attack the free enterprise system.
Michael, I have one last question, and it's more of a Mexico and Latin America question. How is Mexico comparing to other countries? I mean, as far as policies, growth policies, obviously Chile would be the gold standard for business development and free market policies. But how is Mexico ranking with other countries right now?
You're asking me or Israel?
No, Israel. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Well, you know, we know that that you're right. Chile is doing well, but also Peru is doing well. Colombia is doing quite well, and these countries are adapting free market pro trade policies, and that has been helpful. With Mexico, I think that it's one of the bright spots in Latin America. I think that it's fair to say that Mexico is on an upward trend. I think that if we put aside the issue of criminality and organized crime and violence on a purely macro level on the economy side, I think Mexico is on an upward trend. And again, I think that there's a lot to be determined yet. I think it's way too early to say that Mexico is at a point where it needs to be, particularly with so much resources that it has, the human capital potential that it has. But I think that if Peñanito can build upon some of these success stories, I think Mexico could be a contender.
Yeah, Michael, did you want to say something about that? I meant to ask, but I know that would be a topic that you might have something good to say on.
No, absolutely. I agree with Israel. Mexico is the second largest economy in Latin America after Brazil, and it's growing at a very impressive rate. And, something related to what Fausta just asks in her question is the Wall Street Journal was actually published an article regarding Mexico and President Peña Nieto yesterday praising his actions because he was, reforming the energy industry and taking on, telecommunications monopoly. So he's doing pretty well so far
yes.
in his first 100 days.
No, I think he's off to a good start. I agree with you. That's what I'm hearing from a lot of business people in Mexico is that he's off to a good start. Again, he's got a long way to go, but so far he's off to a good start. I think the experience that he had as governor of the state of Mexico, which is one of the one or two largest states in Mexico, and from an industrial standpoint, is a very important state. It may be number one. I think that's helping, isn't it, Israel? That he had that mm-hmm. executive experience, and especially he knows a lot about what it takes to open businesses because that's what he did a lot of in
yes.
the state of Mexico. So I think in that sense it's working out. But Israel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And one more time, tell us about the Heritage Foundation, and especially Libertad, that I enjoy reading every morning with my cup of coffee.
Thank you. Yeah. You're referring to Café con Libertad.
Café con Libertad. There you go.
Yeah.
I was just testing you, Israel, just testing you to see if you remembered the name.
Yeah,
of the
no, of course. We look at it every morning. Café con Libertad, if you speak Spanish, go to www.libertad.org. And if you prefer to read in English, you can go to the Heritage Foundation and sign up for the Morning Bell, which is our daily email newsletter. We talk about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and really all over the world, but, of course, centered on freedom and limited government.
Right. So you decided to call it Café con Libertad, no la campaña
yeah.
de la mañana, right?
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, I think that knowing you, I think that was a good title. But have a great day. Give
okay.
my best to Ray Walzer and everybody there at the foundation.
Great.
And Mike Gonzalez, everybody, just tell them hello and thank you
Will
so
do.
Much for joining
Will
us.
Thank
and
you so much
for everything you do.
Of course, likewise. Thank you, everybody, guys.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back with Michael and with Fausta, and we're going to get into Venezuela. We're going to get into Argentina and everything else that Fausta has been telling us about in her carnival. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and so far, no white smoke. I just took a quick look at the TV, and there's no white smoke, so we don't have a pope yet. Just a quick update: tomorrow, we're going to be doing a very interesting program on Operation Pedro Pan, and we've done several programs before on this with Carlos Eide and Fernando Hernandez, who Carlos, of course, the author of Waiting for Snow in Havana and Learning to Die in Miami, and then, of course, Fernando Hernandez, who was also Pedro Pan, who came to the United States. He wrote that great book called The Cubans, and we did some shows with him. But tomorrow we're going to be talking to a couple of ladies who are in the headquarters of Pedro Pan in Miami, and they're both named Carmen, so that I'm going to be really confused tomorrow with that. But anyway, they're both named Carmen, and the beautiful thing that is happening with Pedro Pan is that they're restoring some of the camps and some of the schools and some of the places that the children used to stay in, and they're restoring all of it, and in some cases are even working to have some of them named special places by the state of Florida. And I think it's a beautiful campaign, and it's something that needs to be done to remind everybody of what happened 50 years ago in many of those camps, when many, many children who are now grandparents and running this organization, what happened to their story, and 14,000 kids. That's a lot of kids. I was just going to say, on this day in history, very quickly, on this day in history, 1942, if you're like me and you like dogs, it was on this day in 1942 that the U.S. Army created the Canine Corps. And that, of course, is the dogs in the military. And if you talk to anybody who's been in Iraq or Afghanistan or has been in service, I think you'll know how valuable many of these beautiful dogs are. They're often German shepherds. And they're just great, they're just a big part of the Army these days, the U.S. Army Canine Corps, founded on this day in 1942. Let's get back to Fausta and to Michael. How are you guys?
Doing great.
Michael,
great.
Are you still on that truck? I don't hear it.
Well, you don't even want to know what that sound that I don't know somehow gets amplified so horribly. It's actually my computer.
I am convinced that it was sabotage. I am convinced. She's been on me because she wants me to pay you more money, and she's been sending me all kinds of emails. She's apparently your agent now. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she is.
She's your agent now, and she's sending me all these messages on Facebook saying that I have to. She says I have to elevate your pay. And I said, well, wait a minute, if I do it to Michael, then I got to do it to Fausta. And if I elevate Michael and I don't do it for Fausta, then she'll be sending me emails reminding me of things I don't want to hear. So Betsy, I'm working on it, okay? Okay, just give us a break, Betsy. But seriously, do either one of you have anyone in the military? I know, Fausta, maybe you do here in the United States. Because this I love these dogs that they use in the U.S. Army. It's just an absolutely beautiful story.
I don't have anybody in the military, but I love dogs, and it really is a very nice story. I also was involved with somebody who was one of the people behind Seeing Eye Dogs in Morristown, and Seeing Eye Dogs are also very dedicated to their masters, to the point that if the master dies, the dog tends to die shortly after.
Yeah. No, it's just amazing, the loyalty between dogs and humans. It's just absolutely, absolutely amazing. Well, let's talk a little bit about Latin America. And I guess the best place to begin, and I'll begin with Michael, is Venezuela. There is now a post-Chavez Venezuela, I guess about a week old. He died, I guess, a week ago. And what are you hearing, Michael? What is your sense?
Well, it's everything but post-Chavez. I had the opportunity of watching the funeral live, and it was a very, very interesting experience. First of all, it's because you see all the tyrants of the world united in one place. You had the dictator from, Belarus, Lukashenko was there with his child. You had a president of Iran. You had Raul Castro. You had a minister from Syria. So basically everybody who is evil in the world was there. The only person that was missing was the president of North Korea. But other than that, everybody was there. It was a very, very interesting event in the sense that, you might
say any whatever you want about Chavez and his followers, but something that's very true about them is they're very passionate and they are convinced about whatever ideology they have right now. The eulogy that it was delivered by President Maduro, basically, it could be compared this, you know, this kind of, I don't know how even explain it, but Chavez became a saint in their view, the leader. He was compared, Maduro compared Chavez to Fidel Castro and Simon Bolivar, which, you know, I mean, especially to Simon Bolivar, I find that, you know, utterly preposterous. But he also referred to Chavez as, you know, a true Christian and a perfect Christian and a Christian of the streets, that basically a Christian that helped the people, the common people and the poor people, which again is a fallacy because prior to Chavez getting sick or becoming sick with cancer, he was not religious at all whatsoever. As a matter of fact, he was always, you know, clashing heads against, you know, the clergy in Venezuela. So it was very, very interesting. I also saw the prayer delivered by Jesse Jackson. Whatever respect I have left for Jesse Jackson was gone. Jesse Jackson referred to, again, to Chavez as an angel, a saint. He repeated something all the time saying that, you know, people like Chavez should not, you know, rest in the ground forever, should not rest in the ground forever. And he repeated that like four times. And he spoke in English, but he's speech was being simultaneously translated into Spanish. It was a total spectacle. The president of Colombia was there. He was also in a very, very special place. Something that caught my attention is that I didn't see at any moment either the president of Brazil, Rousseff, or the president of Argentina. They were not there in the funeral. At least they were not shown on TV during like
no,
the hour
they bailed
and a half,
out early.
And the president of Colombia, he was in the second row. He was right next to Evo Morales and right next to Rafael Correa. And Maduro, again, during his eulogy, he referred to two people only by name, two foreign leaders, one of them being Fidel Castro and the other one being president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, when he was recounting a meeting between Santos and Chavez that took place in Santa Marta, Colombia, where the city in which Bolivar died. And even though less than 5 minutes before Maduro had insulted Colombia, as soon as he mentioned the president of Colombia, Santos was silly enough to get up and start, you know, waving to the people. I mean, it was totally ridiculous. I don't even know why he did that. But, you know, he stood up in the crowd and started waving to the people because he felt he was being recognized, by Maduro by name. And nobody else did. And Maduro also recognized and acknowledged the mission from the U.S. that was sent by President Obama. And as soon as he recognized them and thanked them for being there, he started to insult the U.S., saying that, you know, the U.S., the imperialism will never prevail in Venezuela and the spirit of Chavez will prevail. And as I mentioned just earlier, he did the same with Colombia. You know, he welcomed the president of Colombia, but then he said, "We all know that Colombia is awaiting to be renewed and born again, the great Colombia of Bolivar, et cetera, et cetera." Basically, he's referring to a Colombia model after, you know, Chavez's Venezuela. And he, at some points during the eulogy, he was about to cry when he was describing the struggle of their comandante and saying how Chavez wanted to, you know, leave a political will and ask him and other, you know, ministers to draft something, but they couldn't bring themselves to draft something on his behalf because he was so brilliant that wouldn't be fair to him. And at the end of the whole ceremony, they awarded the family of Chavez a replica of Simon Bolivar's sword and gave it to them. So it was quite a spectacle.
Yes, it was. Fausta, I've got a couple of follow-ups. I want to give Fausta a chance to say something about the first week of the post-Chavez Venezuela.
Well, not to be facetious, but let's be facetious. How many replicas of Bolivar's sword there are? Every time somebody showed up in Venezuela that Chavez liked, they got a replica of Bolivar's sword. I mean, they must be making them in Taiwan by now. I mean, anyway, As for the first week, the
no, they're making them in Cuba, Faust, and they don't work.
That's right. So the opposition candidate already declared himself for the election. They name supposedly there's going to be an election on April 14th. How much of that is rigged, we will find out in time. However, I do not believe by any stretch of the imagination that this will be a free and clean election.
Interesting. Well, I just wanted to say one thing. I mean, I found Reverend Jackson's remarks to be so over the top. I don't know how this man can be taken seriously anymore. He wasn't really a serious man before. But after this, I mean, it's laughable to speak this way about Hugo Chavez. And then the other thing that I, you know, that really bothers me, and this is something Daniel mentioned last week when we spoke with him, is that I think a big fraud was perpetrated here on the people of Venezuela, because they were never told how sick this man really was. I mean, I wonder if the election would have been different if people had known on October 7th that Chavez was so ill he wouldn't make it to Valentine's Day. I mean, it is really amazing to me what a great fraud was done on the people here, and then the way that he was installed as president. I mean, there have to be people in Venezuela of good faith who look at that and say, come on, you know, this was not any respect for the Constitution, Fausta.
Well, not only that, the people of Venezuela don't even know what Chavez was suffering from.
Right.
Other than an unnamed cancer. Now, cancer is a generic term for something like 200 illnesses, different illnesses that have different symptoms, and they attack different organs of the body to varying degrees. It's not the same thing to have skin cancer than what it is to have, say, prostate cancer, for instance. So the Venezuelan public, the Venezuelan government has not even been candid enough to tell the Venezuelans what Chavez had for starters.
No, I agree. So, I agree.
So, you know, there is a great deal of reasons for skepticism, as far
sure.
as, to put it mildly.
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. But you're right. I mean, cancer, what does cancer mean? It kind of reminds me of a story of when we first came to the United States, and my mom would say, every time somebody was sick, they would say, el flu. And
right.
My mom would say, what's el flu? Everybody's sick of el flu, but nobody can explain to me what el flu is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But anyway, so this is, I think, the same thing, cancer, but nobody really knows. But what really, if I was a person in Venezuela, I would be very angry at the fact that it was never said to me. Now, it's one thing, if he had died of a heart attack or something, that's one thing. Or in an accident or whatever. But, they had to know on the 7th of October that he wasn't going to live that much longer. I mean, you just don't deteriorate that quickly without having some background. But let me jump to another country, if I may, here. You mentioned that the president, Michael, you mentioned the president of Argentina was not there or took off early, I think Fausta said. I think she was going to the Falklands for the victory party for the election. That's what it was. She really thought that the election was going to turn out different than the Falklands. And, you know, the Falklands, by 98%, decide to keep part of Britain. That's got to be a slap in the face of Cristina Fernandez, Fausta.
Well, Cristina Fernandez does not view this as a slap in the face, because her position, CNN had a video that I posted in my blog showing Argentinians saying that, of course, the Falklanders are going to vote to remain British because they are British citizens, so what else do you expect? But the Falklands will always belong to Argentina, which makes absolutely no sense.
Well, that's, this lady doesn't make any sense. I mean, this lady is such a joke. But, Michael, what do you make of this thing with the Falklands?
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, the percentage was actually 99.8%. I think that three people out of like 1,500 voted, you know, against it, which is ridiculous. But What Fausta said actually is the way the Argentinians see it. They see the territory is ours, the people, they're not ours because they are, you know, they're colonists. But the islands belong to us, but it's just ridiculous. And again, it's a smokescreen to try to cover up the financial crisis the country is suffering, the declining, in the standard of living that Argentinians have faced for the past 4 years or even 6 years or so. So they try to keep something alive. They're trying to keep something alive to unite the people, around this myth of the Maldivas.
Right. Yeah,
Malvinas.
Yeah, it's just a distraction. I think you would agree with me on that. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're doing our weekly U.S. Latin America show. If you're listening to us for the first time, we try to do this every week and talk about issues related to Latin America. I believe very strongly that the United States and Latin America have to be talking and doing business with each other. It's in our interest. They're our neighbors, and we think it's very important. So we have with us Michael Prada and Fausta Wurtz to talk about these topics. Now, what I'd like to do at this time is give each one of you an opportunity to talk about a story that you've been following or something in Latin America that you think is important at the moment. So let me give Fausta the first crack at it.
Well, I have been, of course, covering a lot of the Hugo Chavez death and aftermath. The thing about this is, what is it going to mean to the rest of Latin America? And that's the important angle, because not only was Chavez subsidizing the Cuban communist regime, he was also subsidizing a lot of unsavory characters too. So that is the thing to look for in the near future. Now, as far as Latin American economies, Peru announced that they had, I believe, almost 7% growth in January, which is an amazing number. And these are real numbers. These numbers are can be verified by international agencies. They're not like in Argentina, where economists are being persecuted, basically, for reporting the truth about inflation.
Yeah. And speaking of Peru, I've been having contacts with the economic section of the Peruvian embassy in Washington, because I would like to bring somebody on the show in the near term to talk about Peru, because Peru is a real success story in South America at the moment. Michael, what are some of the stories you're following?
Well, I'm sticking with Venezuela. I think in America.
I think we lost. You're cracking
and
up.
Like,
and I don't mean mentally. I mean your phone. Yeah, Michael, I'm losing you. So please repeat yourself. Betsy,
can you hear me right now?
I was only joking when I said he's cracking up mentally, okay? Betsy, don't send me an email.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Go ahead and repeat yourself.
Okay. I was saying that I'm going to stick with Venezuela, because it's right now the hotspot of all the events and everything that's going on in Latin America. And I would like to highlight a story about opposition candidate Capriles, who, when he opened, you know, his candidacy for the election of April 14th, which, in my opinion, he has no chance of winning, whether because they're going to be rigged or not. He said that, you know, that the government of Chavez was not transparent, and that he didn't even know when Chavez really died. This, of course, caused a huge controversy, and Chavez's mother, Argenis, replied to him, and Chavez's eldest daughter, Maria Gabriela Chavez, sent a letter saying that she knew politics were dirty, but that she didn't know they were going that dirty. And a lot of members of the opposition, instead of backing Capriles, actually distanced themselves from him and say that, you know, that he shouldn't say those kind of things, and do respect the family and doubt about when Chavez really died. So that was, I thought that was very, very interesting. Something pretty quick that is also very interesting about Venezuela is that now that, you know, you have these two main candidates competing, you know, Maduro and Capriles, each one of them has named their team. I don't know why in Venezuela they named the teams commandos, like, you know, like military commandos.
Yeah.
Well, as smart, you know, in a, I'm thinking very smartly, Capriles has named his commando Simón Bolívar. You know, Simón Bolívar. So Diosdado Cabello was outraged, saying that how dare the opposition say, name their commando after Simón Bolívar, et cetera, et cetera. And
yeah.
He said that on April 14th, the bourgeoisie in Venezuela is going to be crushed forever.
Mm. Wow. That's nice to hear, isn't it, remarks like that. But, I have a feeling that when Chavez got to St. Peter up in heaven, that St. Peter said, this is what you did and this is what you did. And then he read a note from Simón Bolívar saying that Simón Bolívar is so sick and tired of you misusing his name that he wants you to spend 2 more weeks in hell just for that. Because I'm telling you, that's all. I mean, it seems like every other word out of Chavez's mouth was Simón Bolívar. I mean, it's just ridiculous how many times. But let me ask one more topic, and then we'll have to go. We got about 3 or 4 minutes. But the president of Brazil didn't go overboard. The lady president of Brazil did not go overboard in this funeral. And I guess there's speculation. I read something in your blog about that, Fausta. What do you make of it?
I think Dilma didn't want to be categorized as being on the same page as Ahmadinejad, because you realize this was a big photo op for Ahmadinejad, and there huge controversy a few years ago when Lula invited Ahmadinejad to Brazil, and a lot of Brazilians, I mean, there were a lot of demonstrations against that. Eventually, Ahmadinejad did make it to Brazil, but it was kept very much more low-key than it would have been otherwise. So I think Dilma is trying to carve a space for Brazil as an international power, and aligning Brazil with Ahmadinejad, with her being shown on a photo op with Ahmadinejad himself, was just not in quite what Dilma is after.
Right. And Michael, what would Santos get out of being so prominent at this funeral? I mean, I couldn't figure that either.
Well, the problem with Santos is that he's the kind of person that he has nothing to show up for himself. I mean, he never ran for office except when he ran for president. And right now he's trying to outshine former president Álvaro Uribe Vélez. That's why he got involved with this whole peace process, and he wants to show himself as the conciliatory president and friendly to Venezuela. And what he's gaining right now, he's trying to gain support from the left in Colombia, which, regardless of that, hates his guts. Piedad Córdoba, the lady with the turban, the Afro turban that she adopted also until very recently, because prior to that she dressed like anybody else, she was there at the funeral, and she's not going to start liking him better because he was on friendly terms with Chavez and now with Maduro. So he's just being an opportunist, in my opinion, and he looked pretty ridiculous, but because, again, I repeat, he stood up. He's the only person who stood up, and people look at him like, what are you doing? This is a funeral. You're not receiving an award or anything. So he was just trying to show himself in a positive light and trying to kiss someone's rear end. But I don't think it's going to turn, well for him.
Who went from the United States? Now, I don't think Jesse Jackson was part of an official delegation, right? So who went from the United States? I mean, I don't recognize anybody who went to the funeral, Fausta. Do you know it? I think there was a congressman who went, but I don't know who he is.
Yes, there was, Bill Delahunt, who was a former congressman from Massachusetts, and also current congressman Gregory Meeks from New York, both Democrats.
Yes, but I mean, those are not exactly heavyweights in our legislature up here. I mean, they're pretty much what I would call more. They come from the left wing of the Democrat Party. I mean,
yes,
yeah, they're not people up here. Well, that's going to do it for today. Let me just give each one of you an opportunity to talk about your website. Fausta, please tell us about Fausta's blog.
Fausta's blog on Latin American politics, culture, and news, and how they interact with American politics, culture, and news. And I blog every day of the week, but I also have a roundup on Mondays on Latin American news called The Carnival of Latin America.
Right, and that's almost 2 pages long, isn't it? I mean, there's probably 30 or 40 stories altogether, isn't there, Fausta?
I try to include at least a dozen countries every week.
Right.
It's not so much the number of the stories. I try to give an overview, a general overview of more like a snapshot of what the news are for 1 week in 12 countries. Now, some countries, of course, are more prominent than others, because you have Brazil and Mexico, which are the large economies, and then you have Colombia, you have Venezuela because of its prominence currently, and so on. So
right.
I would say, a good dozen countries every week.
Yes, and it's a very valuable resource. I like it a great deal. Michael.
Thanks.
The website for my organization is libertyprosperity.org. Again, that's libertyprosperity.org, and that's the website for the International Center for Democracy, which is an organization that works with conservative movements around the world.
Great. And Fausta, you're going to have to tell us in the next carnival. It's too late for this one, but Cuba was eliminated by the Netherlands in the World Baseball Classic.
In baseball.
And that's pretty bad, really. With all due respect to the Dutch players, and most of them are Americans of Dutch descent. It's not like they brought people from the Netherlands. But that was a real upset. And that's probably not the kind of signal Raul Castro wants to hear. First of all, Chavez dies, so his oil barrels are now all of a sudden at risk. And then his team loses in the World Baseball Classic. Maybe Raul is beginning to think that maybe bad luck is coming his way, because that's a huge defeat for the Cuban team. I mean, they were one of the favorites, as they always are.
And let's hope none of the baseball players decides to become a dictator, because look at Chavez and Fidel Castro, both wanted to be major league players.
That's right. Well, that's right. They both wanted, Castro should have become a major league player. I think history would have been a lot better if he had been drafted by the Washington Senators as he was not a very important prospect. I mean, it gets a bit exaggerated. The Castro regime exaggerates how big of a prospect he was. But he was looked at by the Washington Senators in the late 40s, early 1950s, before he decided to, when he was rejected by the Washington Senators, then he decided to overthrow Batista. So.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that everybody's choice? Like, if I'm not a baseball league player, I'm going to go become a communist dictator? I mean,
yes, but I tell you what, if Castro had to do it all over again, I bet he would have preferred being a major league pitcher.
I think so.
Because I just have a funny feeling that he would have preferred being a major league pitcher. But thank you so much, Fausta. It's always a great pleasure to have you. And Michael, thank you so much. Michael, say goodbye to Betsy, please.
Bye, Betsy.
All right. Bye-bye, Betsy. Thank you for your support. And Fausta, thank you as always. And everybody, have a great day. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.
Thank you, Silvio.